Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 79. Today we discuss a speech presented by Jane Addams titled A Modern Lear, which she presented to the Chicago Woman's Club in 1894 and subsequently published in the journal Survey in 1912. This is part one of the episode where we will discuss the speech and its backstory of Adams's reflections upon witnessing the Pullman Railroad strike of 1894 that became a seminal event in labor relations in the United States. To get the text and other associated readings, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Ralph calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico, the chili capital of the world, also in the United States.
This is Fritjof Wegener calling from Delft in the Netherlands.
And this is Jared Damon calling from Sydney in Australia.
Welcome, everyone.
Great to be here.
Thanks.
Great to be here with you to talk about this very interesting description of the description and summary, really, of the key issues associated with the Pullman strike.
Yeah, and I think it's a timely piece because this is the sort of piece. It's a little different than the usual article that we read, which is, you know, largely an academic study or a theoretical treatise. This is a personal feeling or a reaction, a reflection on one of the seminal movements or seminal actions that occurred in the labor relations movement inside the United States. Ralph, why don't you give us a quick rundown of the context of this work that we're going to study?
All right. So there's two things I think our listeners will appreciate knowing a little bit more about. First is the Pullman strike itself, which occurred from May 11th, 1894. You heard that right, 1894, to July 20th of 1894. In response to financial reverses related to the economic depression that began in 1893, the Pullman Palace Car Company, that's a railroad car manufacturer, cut their already low wages of the workers by about 25%, but did not introduce corresponding reductions in rents and other charges at Pullman, which was a company town built at company expense near Chicago. And this is where most of the Pullman workers lived. As a result, many workers and their families faced starvation. When a delegation of workers tried to present their grievances about low wages, poor living conditions, and 16-hour workdays directly to the company's president, George M. Pullman, he refused to meet with them and ordered them all fired on the spot. The delegation then voted to strike. The strike was a widespread railroad strike and boycott that disrupted railroad traffic in the Midwest of the United States between June and July of 1894. It eventually affected 125,000 to 250,000 railroad workers in 27 states and had a big impact on business as well as the delivery of the mail, which gave President Grover Cleveland and his attorney general a motive to intervene. And it was actually the first time in the history of labor problems in the United States where the federal government had intervened directly. And in fact, there was a court injunction stopping the strike, and many people were jailed. The other thing I think it's useful for people to know, if you haven't read a summary of King Lear, you should, because it will make a lot of what we talk about more understandable. But I'm going to give a very, very short introduction so you can understand the references that we're going to discuss. King Lear is a play about blindness. Blindness to others' motivations, blindness to one's own true nature, blindness to the emptiness of power and privilege, and blindness to the importance of selfless concern for others. King Lear was blind to the role of his absolute power and how it played out in the relationship with his daughters, whom he expects, in the course of the play, to take care of him after he decides, now's the time to divide my kingdom amongst my daughters. And he has three daughters, and one gets completely disinherited, and tragedy befalls her. Interestingly enough, once Lear loses power, he gains insight into the nature of the power and his own personal shortcomings. And it's arguable that he sees the world after he leaves power as it really is, not as power formed a lens for him to see it. But because he's out of power, he now can't do anything about it. So he has this great perspective, but is unable to capitalize on it. And at the very end of the play, he dies after making a symbolic plea that the survivors should see themselves and the world more accurately. It's a great plea, very challenging. And so that's many of these things are going to come back up again as we discuss the nature of the strike.
Yeah, thanks for that, Ralph. And the play King Lear is also interesting because of the role of one of the daughters, which was Cordelia, because she is ultimately the one who first, you could look at it as fails to kowtow to her father's demand for attention or respect. Unlike the two sisters, Goneril and Regan, who basically, you know, lie and fawn over their father and therefore get the kingdom. What the reading that we're going to talk about is basically comparing the leadership of the Pullman Company against the town of Pullman as to King Lear and Cordelia, the youngest daughter. And this is the way in which, you know, the article, which we're going to now cover, which will be Shift to the Ringing Itself, A Modern Lear by Jane Addams. As I said in the very beginning, this is a very, very deep personal reflection. This is not written as a treatise. This is a reaction, or trying to understand what was a very, very violent labor relations action. How did it occur? Why did it occur? And what can we learn from it? And she uses King Lear as sort of like the analogy. Before we get into the reading, Fritjof, why don't you give us a little bit of background on Jane Addams, why she is an important figure, and what role she's, you know, playing in this.
Yeah, so an important thing to know about Jane Addams is that she generally is considered as being one of the key pragmatists. So most often we hear the four names of Pierce and Dewey and James and Meade, but actually Follett, Mary Parker Follett and Jane Addams should be right within that group because they've done really important work. And I think actually in a way, I always see them almost as the true pragmatists in the sense of that they were really in practice working, showing how these ideas work in practice. And really had an important role in these kind of social movements, labor movements, etc. in the US. And at the same time, we need to realize that, the two women of the six, they're not being as recognized, arguably on the one hand, because their style of writing maybe was, so normal, so clear, that it maybe didn't convey always how big the ideas were that they were talking about. But also we have to realize this is like 100 more years old, so the role of women in society was quite different. And there's also like this feminist strain in pragmatism, which I think is really important and that we should recognize. And therefore it's really interesting to see in this in that sense quite concrete story all the deep ideas that she talks about and how important they are to better understand labor relations.
Yeah, I think it's also worth mentioning that she was also quite the philanthropist. Jane Addams was I don't know if she was necessarily the founder, but she was very heavily involved in the Settlement House movement during this time, which was an effort to try to provide opportunities for the poor to live among or to be exposed to the upper or middle classes by basically providing housing within upper or middle class districts and vice versa, looking for middle class volunteers to live in more impoverished settings as a way of trying to level the playing field by exposure. Being exposed to those who are different from you is a way of gaining empathy, gaining greater understanding, and therefore hopefully leading to greater equity and inclusion down the road.
Well, and I would add, it's probably more than just exposure. I think that was a good place to start. But what you see in many of the prevailing attitudes towards helping people who are disadvantaged or not in good circumstances, it was also a form of mentoring. There was a lot of expectation that the upper classes or the people who are more successful would mentor and help these people rise out of that situation. So the concept of helping people who were disadvantaged was more than just writing a check. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but it extended to this building life skills aspect, which I think is what you were talking about, Tom.
Maybe for completeness' sake, of course, we're talking here about the Hull House, and sort of say the idea that like bring these ideas into practice and experimenting, not in the lab sense, but in the real experiment sense, and arguably sort of say Jane Addams seeing that the real experiment is the one in practice, and the lab experiment is just kind of like a specific version of that, and showing in practice how these ideas work like around the Hull House.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, and we'll make the comment, Jane Addams was close to the action, so to speak, which she lived nearby where the strikes were taking place, and therefore she had, a particular perspective on what had occurred, and she wasn't writing from a distance.
Yeah, that's a very, very, very good point. But it certainly, what it does is it gives a sense of her perspective as she's watching these events unfold and why it perhaps was, you know, deeply personal to her. Because, the Pullman strike ultimately was a very, very violent action. This was a very messy situation. And a lot of what she wrote in the piece speaks to a horror as to how this played out. A Modern Lear was originally a speech that she delivered, which she ultimately wrote down, you know, refined and published in a journal later. But this is basically trying to understand how could it have been that A, the people were so driven to violence, and B, the reactions, you know, how it was that the leader of the Pullman Company was so out of touch with what the situation was unfolding, that violence could have been averted, you know, there was no reason for violence to have occurred unless there was a breakdown of some kind that wasn't well understood. And this is
why she decided to
use King Lear as the metaphor.
Right. Well, and she's got that line in there. It goes right to the heart of what you were talking about, which is she talks about it being an ethical lesson, right? So it's not just an issue of labor relations and social relations, although she does talk about those. But she says, to endure is all we can hope for. It is impossible to justify the rage and riot in a civilized community to whom the methods of conciliation and control were open. And so, like Fridolf was talking about, this there's this very ultimate pragmatist aspect where she's trying to understand and make sense through this discourse of how that could have happened. And it's a little, I would say the best analog we have for it now in the United States is the Black Lives Matter kinds of protests. And I know there's lots of differences, right? But you could hear many people in the United States, and I'm sure it was talked about overseas, how could this happen? How could people be this angry? How could you have these violent protests? And so the parallels are probably out there, and we're not going to really talk about them, but there's that sense of how did this come about? And that, what I love about the paper is if you just read it, if you read it like it's an academic paper, it's going to be a struggle. And if you read it more like, as Fridolf was talking about, an exploration of what's pragmatic and what seems to work and what these issues are, then you can see she's using this speech as a way to work these things out. And as Tom said, then the King Lear analogy comes clear to her. And it's not perfect because of course, he's a fictional character, and a lot of the things in the play are amped up, like they are in movies and television, for dramatic effect. But it really is insightful to think about this, and we'll get into that further into the conversation. I just thought that was, and one thing I wanted to mention that Fridolf said, and I think it was important, is that pragmatism is all about experimenting and outside a lab. And what I was thinking about when he was talking about that was, a lot of times people will do experiments with social experiments or others where they have to take a subset of the data or a subset of the issues and focus narrowly, which is the nature of some kinds of experiments. Pragmatists are more like, no, let's get out of the lab and let's see how this works in the real world. And the real world is messy. So sometimes you have kind of messy experiments, but that's what makes pragmatism so attractive, is that they're not trying to simplify things. They're trying to say, how does this work in the real world? And how do these tools work? So I thought that was a very good point you made, Fridolf.
Maybe to build on that, pragmatism in that sense is, of course, kind of like going away from the rationalism towards the empiricism, in the sense of like experience in the end, so to say, really shows if the ideas work or not. And that one of the key problems was that even though you think you're philanthropic and even though you think you take care of your employees, etc., you can't just think that you know what they want. You also can't assume that they know what they want or what they really need. You have to see in practice, okay, but like, so now we've done that, is it actually working? And so they see once you've built the town, once you established certain relations there, if it's actually working as intended. And so to say, that's why the experience is so important. That's why the dialogue is so important, that all the different perspectives are being integrated with each other. And that arguably, yeah, something was wrong here. So good intentions still led to problematic situations.
Yeah, no question. And this problematic situation, I mean, we have to think about what company towns were at the time as well. I think that's an important context to say, because, you know, in past episodes, I've talked about Milton Hershey and the company town of Hershey, Pennsylvania. And it's generally been, you know, held up as a good example where a leader of a corporation is providing for the people and puts the people's needs first. Now, company towns were not necessarily that way. Like, they were not robust and necessarily benevolent in their implementation. A lot of company towns, and I think this accurately describes Pullman, were basically, they were more like dormitories. I mean, you know, you basically provide minimal services, minimal capabilities. But worse, the part that I think that this was really difficult is that because the company owned it, the company had total power over the living conditions, to which a lot of company towns, I don't know that I saw that this was specifically the case in Pullman, but a lot of company towns, the companies also owned the businesses that operated in there, operating the grocery stores, operating the laundromats, operating this all of these sorts of facilities. And so individuals who live in these company towns did not necessarily have a lot of choice. They didn't have opportunities to check out other towns or, you know, go other places or what have you. It was all inside the arms of the company. This is where I think the analogy of King Lear becomes really interesting. And yes, acknowledging that it's a fictional character, however, it was also inspired, supposedly, by real medieval kings whose, you know, I mean, how much of a real-world adaptation is left to the historians, we won't debate it. But here it is, you know, I, the leader of the company, have provided you with this, and I provided you with this. I gave you housing, I gave you parks, I gave you all of this stuff, and it's all my largesse. How dare you strike back at me it this way? Which is very much in line with, you know, say, the reaction of King Lear to when Cordelia, you know, to shower love upon the king, refused to do so because it just wasn't right. It was the same kind of reaction of indignation, of, you know, so there's a, you know, Shakespeare was a great writer, there's no question about it. He captured the spirit of indignation just as well. Certainly, Adams captured the indignation that was felt by the Pullman Company as these, you know, this idea of a wildcat strike started to emerge.
Well, and also you hit on one of the key themes that Adams discusses in her speech, this idea of the how dare the workers? You know, they're ungrateful for what Pullman has done for them. So you don't have to be George Pullman. Apparently that was a strain of in society or people, some responses to this action by the workers. Oh, he's done all this great stuff and it's been ungratefully received, as she said. And then the other theme that we touched a little bit on, but we'll talk about it more as we go through the text, is that, well, there's a social consciousness emerging amongst the workers. That's what makes this article so interesting, this idea that as part of the Industrial Revolution, it's really easy to get lost in the Taylorism and some pragmatism, and I don't mean that in a bad way, right? But this, like, what works at work and what are these experiments we do to find the best level of production, and yet miss the part that Tom mentioned. You know, you can provide structures or dormitories for people, but that's not all you need. And so there was this change that was becoming evident that apparently they want more. They want more say in what's happening, and not necessarily just at work, but social relations. And it's developing amongst the working people and basically exploded as a result of these kinds of issues. So clearly something was going on because the reaction was so quick, so strong. I don't want to say violent because there was violence on both sides. And later she talks about this in the introductory section. She talks about the industrial relationship. She doesn't go too deeply into that, but I thought that was a fascinating term to use, this idea of what's the relationship between the worker and groups of workers and the employer. Is it just one-on-one, or is there something more? And she talks about this idea that, well, when you have groups of people, whether it's groups of managers and leaders trying to make a profit and get results, or groups of workers in these collections that had heretofore not occurred in the working place, what's changing? What's happening? And that's why this is so interesting. As she explores this, what are the interests of the company? What are the interests of the workers? And she identifies there's a clash.
Yeah, good point, Ralph. And I think in your introduction, you made the point that King Lear is very much about being blind to things that are staring you in the face. And that comes across in the paper. Adams is in despair that Pullman, a well-intentioned philanthropist, might be so blind to the social movement happening within the lives and the work of these people who he supposedly had such an interest in, that they were being, I guess, awakened to workers' rights and in the thinking around a new industrial relationship, as you say, she mentions in the paper. And picking, relating back to Fritjof's point, for the pragmatist, the proof is very much in the eating of the pudding. Yes, while Pullman built this wonderful town, from one perspective, it looks like he built this wonderful town. In effect, as it says in the reading, the shops were managed, however, not for the development of the workmen thus socialized, but for the interests of the company owning the capital. And he was not, I guess, insightful enough to recognize that this was taking place. And, furthermore, I think it mentions in the paper that they'd built these wonderful theaters and the like, but none of the residents, as in the workers, were able to attend them because they were priced out of their league. And this all kind of fed into this dynamic that was bubbling up in the town. And the onset of, I guess, the depression just broke the back and was the tipping point of all that was bubbling under the surface.
Right. So here's something I want to throw out there from the pragmatism point of view, because like Fritjof, I'm also very interested in the pragmatism aspect of this. Fritjof, do you think that in a way, I understand the Lear analogy, but do you think also in a way this idea of what Jared was just talking about, this idea that you built the structures, you built this community without the understanding that how it builds community and the social relations, and it appeared the company had this very fixed view of what the social relation was or what the company's responsibility workers were. So here's my question to you. Does that look to you like it's anti-pragmatism, right? You're not paying attention, or you're not learning. You're blinded, as Jared was talking about. And yet the data is telling you one thing, and you're, maybe I shouldn't say stuck, but you have this other view, like Lear did. Okay, here's this traditionalist view of the family, and my daughter should love me unconditionally. I shouldn't have these issues. And here the company has got this traditionalist view of philanthropy, and we can talk about that later, but of what they did, and yet doesn't seem to be learning. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I wanted to read out a small part of the paper, because I think Jane Adams really nicely captures these ideas here, and the pragmatist ideas also become clear. So just to read out, because I think she puts it really beautifully, what Jared just was talking about, that the theater was complete in equipment and beautiful in design, but too costly for a troupe who depended upon the patronage of mechanics, as the church was too expensive to be rented continuously. We can imagine the founder of the town slowly darkening his glints of memory and forgetting the common stock of experience which he held with his men. He cultivated the great and noble impulses of the benefactor until the power of attaining a simple human relationship with his employees, that of frank equality with them, was gone from him. He too lost the faculty of affectionate interpretation and demanded a sign. He and his employees had no mutual interest in a common cause. And I think, I don't know, it's almost poetic the way she writes it. It's really beautiful. But so to say, just with the example of the theater, like, what good is a theater that looks good but that you can't use? It's no good. That understanding that you don't design on paper, you design for actual, so to say, what people experience. That's why we put so much emphasis on user experience when we are designing software, when we're designing products, etc. Because in the end, that's what matters, and not just your intentions. But I think also what is interesting here is kind of like the progressiveness, that even though in the beginning you have good intentions, that things, you know, can change over time, and you can kind of like lose yourself in this rational ideas that you've thought up, but that you're not really in touch anymore with the common stock of experience, that all of us are humans, and all of us in that sense are also connected through experience. But that also requires kind of like the dialogue and the engagement with each other. And I think the other thing is that he and his employees had no mutual interest in a common cause. So Mary Parker Follett, she talks about the unifying purpose, and she gives the example of I think, I'm not sure if it's her or someone else as an example, but the example of, say, Ralph and I, we're fighting over an orange, like we're fighting it out, and instead of asking, hey, Ralph, why do you want the orange? And he wants the orange peel because he wants to bake something for Christmas, and I want the juice, so I only want the inside. But that would have required us to actually have a dialogue and actually understand, okay, what do you need? What do I actually need? Not just what you want, but actually what do I need? Because maybe I still would have said, like, I want the orange, and also Ralph wants the orange. No, what you really need? Okay, what I need actually is the juice. And what he actually needs is the peel. This is a really important point, kind of like the interest, kind of also think of Hannah Arendt, like the interest as in like what connects us? What's in between us? And that's somehow missing. And that when you plan a town like this, like the social relations, you can't engineer them. They kind of like also emerge over time, and there's things changing over time, and you have to be aware of them. You can't like design it once, engineer it once, and then be finished with it. And I think that all really nicely comes out.
Yeah, as a quick aside, we have a negotiation exercise that we do at my institution where it's olives. So you have two parties, one who needs the flesh of the olive in order to pursue for some sort of a medical miracle. And then the other party needs only the pit, with certain information hidden from each other and with cues that basically say that, there's a third party, the one who's selling the olives. And so the purpose of the exercise is to try to convince, you know, the seller to sell the olives to one party or the other, because there's no middle ground here. You either have to, it's all or nothing. You either get all the olives in order to get the most out of it. I offer that as an aside because it is, I think, very, very interesting to think about, you know, a situation where in an ideal setting, you would the parties should be equal in a negotiation where you've got interests. Then there was a lot of room for shared interests to be pursued here, but there was no incentive. I don't know. I guess would be a way to put it. There didn't seem to be any incentive to pursue those shared interests. And now it's clear Adams, as you read this piece, it's very, very clear that Adams has a certain leaning towards the workers in this particular case, but she isn't letting them off the hook either. In the piece around halfway through, she talks about how, on the labor side, that on the one hand, the movement to strike was on the basis of an unselfish impulse, was what she had termed it as. You know, the initial reaction or recognition that the workers are getting squeezed because the company, on the basis of its financial situation, just arbitrarily cuts wages while still owning, you know, still keeping the rents the same, you know. So there's a reason for the workers to be upset. There's a reason for them to band together. There's a reason for them to move. But then in the end, she gets upset about the fact that the workers themselves had taken the violent route as chosen to, you know, basically an insurrection as opposed to just a peaceful strike. Let me just say that the movement was ill-directed and that it was ill-timed and disastrous in results, that it stirred up and became confused in the minds of the public with the elements of riot and bloodshed. Can never touch the fact that it started from an unselfish impulse. So she's excusing the initial reason, But she's not excusing the fact that the situation had gotten so quickly out of hand from the rioting and the violence that occurred. In a similar way, she drew it parallel with the actions of Cordelia. After she had been basically banished from the kingdom, she's married off to the King of France and eventually leads the French forces in an invasion of England. She drew that parallel as well to say that, you know, here it is, the workers, their viewpoints have been so confined. We take them out of the context, and they get to see much more of what's going on beyond the borders of their company town, and recognize just how unjust and how wrong they are. And they're going to rise up. They're going to take action. They're going to do something about it, just as Cordelia did as she moves off to France, realizes what a terrible situation she has left, and decides, all right, let's just go ahead and conquer England. Let's take the country away, or the crown away from this awful king.
Well, and I think that's a interesting way to look at the even-handedness she's trying to use in the article. You can tell she's got the sympathy Tom mentioned for the workers, but she says, hey, they're not without blame. And I think she's taking a good look at that and saying, yes, they were guilty of the violence. Yes, they were demanding a lot. And then she uses an analogy. She talks about emancipation of slaves, right? The workers are seeking emancipation or more say in working conditions and social relations. And she said, look, if all you're focusing on, if all they are focusing on is emancipation and not what the employer needs, then it's just as problematic for them as it is for the employer. That the people who, if you need to be emancipated, you need to look at what the power side stands to lose and have some affinity for that or understanding. She said, otherwise, you're just focused on your own needs. And that's just as bad in a different way as the employers focusing only on theirs. And she says, look, you just become flesh pots. You're focusing on, I thought that was a great expression, a flesh pot about what you need and not on human affection and social justice. And that's what we were talking about before. And so if you don't touch and connect with the people who are on the other side of this equation, like Fridolf and Tom were talking about in these kind of negotiations, then it's all just win-lose. And then it's whoever can fight to the death or whoever can be, you know, more violent first. And that never works out very well for either side.
And I think this is kind of like the pragmatist aspects also that take our insurance work or on the framing, et cetera, but also obviously in meat work and et cetera, that Adams writes here, he felt himself right. So he, director or the president of the company, he felt himself right from the commercial standpoint and could not see the situation from the social standpoint. For years, he had gradually accustomed himself to the thought that his motive was beyond reproach, that his attitude to his town was always righteous and philanthropic. Habit held him persistent in this view of the case through all the changing conditions. And so that's like highlighting, like, even if all the facts, so to say, are known, like still the perspective you take and how you relate all the different facts, also how you value them, obviously, would still make it possible to have very different perspectives. And indeed, like if you look at it purely from a commercial and from a money perspective, you might come to this conclusion. But if you take a bigger perspective, include the relationships, the social relationships, then you would see, hey, this is not good. But what I also like here is kind of like the role of habit. That, so to say, over time, you kind of like come accustomed to ways being a certain way. And you don't necessarily start doubting that. And that's why you're kind of like stuck in a rut mentally, also the way that you approach a situation, that you can't really get out of it.
Yeah. And Adams despairs of the fact, or from her perspective, that it did not need to be this way. There's no reason why both parties couldn't have had a better appreciation of each other's grievances, but also their good intentions, perhaps, from where their actions rise up. And her frustration, I mean, you can see it, comes about because the president of the company, as she quotes in the piece, the president of the company holds that there's nothing to arbitrate. So he was so blind to the fact that he might benefit from sitting down and understanding what are the grievances of his workers and perhaps sharing with them some of his disappointment that from his perspective, they haven't appreciated his philanthropy. I mean, for me, yeah, that was a a bit of a shock, and it kind of relates to the point Fritjof and Tom were making about the negotiation exercises. Like, I mean, surely the number one thing to do, and maybe this is just kind of our training in negotiation, is you got to sit down and understand what are the interests of the other party first. If you're not willing to have that conversation, then yeah, how are you meant to work things out? If we can't talk, how can we get along?
Well, and one of the things, Tom, I think it's important to emphasize in Tom's organization, it's a university educational institution designed to help mid-career leaders. In this particular case, it happens to be the military, but one of the things Tom talks about is that there's this idea of, well, if you always approach these confrontations, as Jared was talking about, from the position of power, or I have nothing to learn from these other people, it's going to cause you problems. And so they've got this, I know Tom can talk a little bit more about this, but one of the things I just want to emphasize, you know, it's a challenge, especially when we look back at Mary Parker Follett or Frederick Winslow Taylor. When we see the world today, and Jared was, I think, was spot on when he said, well, why wouldn't you do this? Why wouldn't you want to learn what the workers' concerns were? And we've evolved pretty far in our concept of labor relations and what's appropriate. And we have quite a few companies that, I don't want to say we take it for granted, but it's something that all four of us are struggling a little bit to think about. Why would you take this dictatorial approach? Or how could your philanthropy go so far as to building this town, but only get, I think it was Fritjof that said this, only get the structures in place, the physical structures in place, not the social structures. And so she has a line here. She's talking about the parallels with King Lear. It's a really good line in the first five pages. We may in later years learn to look back upon the industrial relationships in which we are now placed as quite as incomprehensible and selfish, and quite as barbaric and undeveloped as was the family relationship between Lear and his daughter. And so I think it's fascinating from an organizational science point of view to get this little snapshot back in time, and we can see, wow, we really have moved a long way in the concept of social relations, justice, negotiating, understanding what all parties to a negotiation need. Because all of you guys have said that, and I think that's important, and it almost looks barbaric to us to look back and say, wow, did they really think that way, you know, back in the day?
Yeah, but we always have to be careful that, you know, not all labor relations, you know, since this time have followed this path. I think, we have certainly seen plenty of instances in which labor relations can become so adversarial where it seems like the shared interest is the destruction of the other party. This is where I think the pragmatist view becomes really, really useful. Because, you know, if you find yourself, you know, I can't think of a scenario where there's any good outcome, any reasonable outcome that could come in a case where the two sides are simply there to destroy the other. It, you know, in that sort of a polarized situation, there's very little room for anything. The pragmatist view, in my mind, is really the right one to think about where appears to be no shared interest. What shared interest could be drawn? And that comes from the problematic situation that Fritjof mentioned before.
I do want to make a crucial distinction. It's not a common or shared interest. It's a unifying.
Yeah.
So
there we go.
In the end, like realizing our like with the orange example, like our common interest is not orange. We have a unifying interest. We have a unifying purpose. Like maybe we both want more oranges so we can split them up and I can get my juice and he can get the peel. But in the end, it's not the same. And that's sort of say at the same time also the beauty, because it's not a zero sum game. And that's why like the idea of the win-win situation comes from Mary Parker Follett, because she was trying to highlight that if both sides sort of say are open and engage in dialogue, we can find ways to sort of say get value for both sides that doesn't have to cost sort of say the other side. It's not a zero sum game. But for that, you in a way, you actually need to find sort of say what's not your shared interest, so you don't have to fight for it. But
right,
kind of
right.
Like, okay, how can we together get sort of say what we want, or at least kind of like a fair share? And that's also why Mary Parker Follett kind of like was against already the way that a lot of the labor relations was set up, because it always made it seem like we're in the fight here. instead of seeing it as, hey, but this is, it's also about imagination. It's also about creativity. How can we best use the situation?
Yeah, I think that was a great point you made about the unifying interest, because it is really a crucial distinction. And I know Tom talks about this periodically. The idea that sometimes when you're negotiating, or Jared was talking about, you're looking for this unifying interest, you'll often start out by saying, well, what do we agree on? What are the things that we think we agree on initially? And I sometimes think now that I've heard Fridtjof mention that's a step down the path of identifying that unifying interest. That maybe it's not obvious when you start. And what you need to do actually before you start advocating your point is trying to discover what that unifying interest is, because it's so important.
On the other hand, that can also lead down a path where you basically agree upon everything that isn't actually all of that crucial, and then fail when it comes to actually talking about the issues, you know, the problematic situation at its core.
You're right. If you use that as a means to avoid what you're talking about, as opposed to warm up, that's the way I was thinking, but you're right. You can use it as a way to avoid the key issues, then it's not helping you any. Absolutely.
And I want to make one more distinction. I think that's important from pragmatist thought, that like it's not a problematic situation as such. It's kind of like a situation where like you maybe are not sure what you're supposed to do, or you just plan or don't know what to do anymore because this is a really new situation. It's about that there is a quality in the situation that is the problem, but it's kind of like it takes actual work to find what the problem is. And all too often that we start out thinking we already know what the problem is, and then we're stuck in this is the problem and therefore this is the solution, and we never get out of this frame. And that you really have to question yourself, but have I really understood what these people want? Do they really want the beautiful theater, or do they want actual theater that actually works?
One of the things I think we haven't talked about yet, which is worthy of some dialogue, is this idea of philanthropy is not justice. Right, she explores it in a really interesting way, and I think it's a good takeoff from the pragmatism beginnings to now consider this further. Another one I saw was this idea that the world has changed, but I think it's worth emphasizing a little bit because we talked about it some, where the model of employment changed, and so does the social needs of the workers, and there's some stickiness going on here. And then the last one I had, because we've already covered workers, that was the very last one I had. But I think this moral struggle versus commercial interest, I think we have touched upon that, but it may be worth some more conversation unless you guys have something. So I thought those three things is kind of interesting. But if you guys have something you really want to bring up or you think goes deeper.
Building on this, I really like this moment where she talks about the zeitgeist, because I think that's kind of like where it really comes out here, when she talks about insofar as philanthropists are cut off from the influence of the zeitgeist, from the code of ethics, which rule the body of men, from the great moral life springing from our common experiences. I think that's a really nice quote that can kind of like lead us into discussing how this is relevant. Because I think like you can take this quote almost like one-to-one translate it to whatever other labor situation you have for right now.
Good, good. And that's kind of how I mean him, right? Because we've done the how does this look in the past part, and now we can talk about what some of these key issues are and where we think we go with
I want to talk about this being like using metaphor in this way, that maybe we should do it also more often as scholars? Or is this maybe too meta?
That's a great idea. You think that's a good sum up thing though, kind of near the end? Bring that up, and then we'll go down that path, because I completely agree with you. It's something that we don't often use, and because we have a different style of communicating, but it's very powerful here.
Just checking, like, it is a metaphor. It's not an analogy, right?
Right, exactly.
Because it's almost an analogy. But yeah.
She says analogy at some point. Yeah, on page 8. Curious analogy. I mean, it does make me think about Amazon and their kind of labor relations at the moment. I don't know if we want to maybe pick that up. I did perceive some similarities.
Well, I think that's worth talking about, whether you use Amazon specifically or gig economy, and what role do the workers have in connection with the companies that just piecework, and you're a contractor, or I believe that's what they call it, or something else. And so you could use Amazon as an example, but you could use food delivery people or any of them about that. So I think that would be a good one to go down as far as, hey, here's some things that we're struggling with now, where the old models aren't really working, and we have these new ideas, and yet it's not, as Fridtjof was saying, it's not just more of what we've done. You have to rethink what we've done. So this is sort of an inspiration for doing that.
What I really liked about this article is Adams calls herself an analogy, but the use of an analogy to illustrate and more deeply understand a situation that you're facing. And that an analogy here is a really good communication device, and also kind of like enriches our understanding of the situation to kind of like see how is it similar, how is it not similar. And I like looking at the article from kind of like three steps away, I think it's really interesting that she picked up this supposedly real but also somewhat imagined situation story of King Lear and then applies that to illustrate a current situation. Because I think that also makes maybe the both sides kind of like more relatable, because also in King Lear, I guess you can also relate with both sides. So I find it really interesting that she uses this analogy going so far. But I think that's a really interesting approach. And I wish maybe that we dared more often to use this form of writing an article.
I think you have a good point, because oftentimes you say, well, we need all this data, or we need to look at what this theorist said. And I was a little resistant initially at the King Lear analogy, and particularly when she starts imagining what George Pullman was thinking. I'm always a little nervous when people do that. But I see now, and I think Fritjof's comments make that clearer, is that it's not meant to say, well, he's just like King Lear. It's to explore the idea, get you to think a little bit more deeply about these issues, as opposed to just binary. Oh, they were ungrateful, or the company wasn't interested in the social relations. It's actually much deeper than that. And so through the analogy of King Lear, you can start to see, oh, there's different ways to think about this. And it explores other themes and possibilities that might not have been so easy to do in the standard academic paper format. So that's what I thought. That was a very useful device or approach.
And I think maybe the talking about the imagination part, I think that's also a very pragmatist thing. So as much as pragmatism is about experience and sort of say what's happening, etc., it's still very much about creativity. So I mean, for let's sort of say one of the key resources for her is creative experience. That's kind of already in the title. So imagination is a really important part. And like even in writing an article, if you're writing it kind of like from a pragmatist perspective, pragmatist paradigm, like this kind of imagination can be really useful. As long as you're not saying it is like that, it's more kind of like a counterfactual or kind of like a thought experiment, etc. And it's more kind of like exploring how it may be, how it could be, etc., to have a better understanding. And that's a really that imagination part. I think that's actually really one of the differentiating aspects of pragmatism.
Now, on the other hand, for our listeners, we did explore another reading or book, Images of Organization, where metaphor was used quite extensively. And we also have to remind ourselves that, you know, these sorts of literary devices have their limitations. And so, you know, and one of the things we should mention is that, her focus on this was only one episode of the Pullman strike. You know, this was basically what had happened between the company and the town that precipitated or led to. There's so many other things that happened in the strike where this analogy might not hold. So, you know, we don't know. We haven't explored it. But she did not. This was beyond the scope of what she was writing about. So we just, you know, yes, the literary devices are wonderful things. We just have to be careful when recognizing their limitations.
Yeah, and I want to make the point. I mean, yeah, Tom, you mentioned the images of organization discussion back in episode 41, I believe, which I think Ralph and yourself were both a part of. I guess, yeah, metaphors are almost a little bit more limiting in that they don't have the same complexity as an analogy to a Shakespearean play. Perhaps there's more opportunity to use these sort of literary devices and analogy in particular to explore the complexity of what is a complex dynamic. But one point to make is that doing so presupposes some sort of understanding of King Lear in the first place. Ralph gave a really great summary of what the play is about. And, you know, I studied it way back in high school, and even I was struggling to remember what exactly was going on and to join the dots and make the connections to the Pullman strike. So it is hard, I think, to find an appropriate analogy which people can grasp hold of and understand and use it to actually improve their understanding of what was going on, as opposed to just maybe confusing it.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Audner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.